Okay, so today we're going deep on something I think a lot of people, even today, have a ton of questions about. First Corinthians chapter 7, verses 1 through 7a. This is Paul's initial response to the Corinthian church about marriage and sex.
It's funny, those are always popular
Oh
topics.
yeah, always super relevant.
Still relevant today.
Right, absolutely.
So hopefully, those of you listening, you can take away a few things from this ancient text.
Yeah, and you've got a great source for this.
Yeah, so we're looking at a lecture by Dr. Gary Metters,
Okay.
and this is one of many in a series on 1 Corinthians.
Right.
So we're going to try to give you the best overview we can of this material and unpack it a bit.
Right, sounds good.
So to get started, I think it's helpful to understand like the situation in Corinth when Paul is writing this letter.
Yeah, that's always a good place to start, right? The context.
Yeah, because it's really easy to just read the Bible and be like,
Right.
okay, well, this is
At
what
the
it's.
time, this is what it means to me today.
Right.
Great. And not fully grasp what the original intent was.
Yeah.
So thankfully, Dr. Metters walks us through that a little bit. So by the time you get to chapter 7, the conversation kind of shifts.
Oh, okay.
In the earlier chapters of 1 Corinthians, Paul's dealing with some stuff that he's heard about.
Oh, so like third-party information?
Yeah, like there were some problems reported from Chloe's household.
Okay.
And like various rumors about sexual immorality and even lawsuits within the church.
Wow, so a lot of drama.
Oh yeah, huge
Well,
problems.
yeah.
And so that's all kind of dealt with in those first few chapters 1 through 6.
Okay.
But then as you get to chapter 7, Paul starts responding to specific questions that the Corinthians wrote to him.
Interesting. So they're actually getting to respond now.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they've got their own questions.
Got it.
But the interesting thing is Metters points out that these might not have been like innocent questions. Like some of them sound kind of like they're trying to corner Paul.
Okay, so they're maybe challenging him a bit.
All
So
right.
it's almost like they already have an answer in mind,
Gotcha.
and they're trying to get Paul to like support their viewpoint.
Okay, interesting.
So it's important to read it with that in mind.
I see.
Before we jump into chapter 7, though, I think it's helpful to just quickly look at the structure of the rest of 1 Corinthians,
Yeah.
just to get a sense of where we're at in the bigger picture.
Yeah, good idea.
So after chapter 7, Paul goes on to discuss food offered to idols,
Okay.
church order,
Right.
like gender roles and the Lord's Supper,
Right.
spiritual gifts, resurrection,
Okay.
a collection for the believers in Jerusalem,
Got it.
and then he kind of wraps things up.
All right.
So chapter 7 is kind of a pivotal moment in the letter.
I see.
It's where he starts directly engaging with the Corinthians' questions.
Okay, so this is like the Q&A portion.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, Metters points out this really interesting detail
Okay.
that marks this transition.
Right.
So there's this Greek term, peridē.
Perideia, which translates to like now concerning.
Okay.
And Paul uses this pretty often in his letters
Right.
to kind of signal a new subject
So like a
or
heading almost.
yeah,
Oh,
exactly.
by that.
You'll see this phrase in the NIV 2011 at the beginning of chapter 7.
Okay.
But some older translations like the ASV, NASB, RSV,
Right.
they stick with now concerning. It's just
Right.
a small detail, but it kind of helps you understand that Paul is directly addressing the Corinthians and their questions.
Okay.
So in chapter 7, Paul basically gives a two-part response.
Okay.
Verses 1 to 24 are focused on general issues of sex and marriage.
Right.
And then verses 25 to 40 are specifically addressing the unmarried.
Got it.
So for our deep dive today, we're going to focus primarily on verses 1 through 7a.
Okay, those first two verses.
Yeah, which Metters kind of labels marriage realities normative and sexual.
Okay, interesting.
So let's jump right into verse 1.
All right.
It starts out now for the matters you wrote about. It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman.
Okay, so that's how it starts out.
Right? And right away, it raises a question.
Okay, what's that?
Is this Paul's own opinion?
Right.
Or is he actually quoting something the Corinthians wrote to him?
Oh, I see.
Like, is he saying this is what I think, or is he saying this is what you're saying?
Got it.
And that's something that a lot of scholars debate.
Right.
But according to Metters, the most likely scenario
Okay.
is that this was like a common saying or a question that was kind of floating around in the Corinthian church.
Oh, so it was already an idea they were grappling with. Yeah.
Exactly. And it seems to reflect a kind of asceticism.
Okay.
So for those who might not be familiar with that term,
Right.
asceticism basically means the belief that avoiding physical pleasures like sex was like a more spiritual path.
So the less you indulge in physical pleasure, the closer you are to God.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
So that's kind of the context that Paul is responding to.
All right, so how does he respond?
Right. So knowing that really changes how you interpret the rest of the chapter. If this is a Corinthian idea, then Paul's subsequent words are a direct response to it.
Okay.
Like he's correcting a potentially misleading viewpoint.
Interesting.
Now, this is where Metters gets kind of fired up.
Okay.
He actually criticizes some older translations of the NIV.
Okay.
Specifically ones that rendered verse 1 as "it is good for a man not to marry."
Oh, I see.
He calls it a horrible translation.
Wow. Strong words.
Yeah, because it totally misrepresents the message of the chapter.
Right.
And, like, goes against the whole idea of the creation mandate in Genesis. Like, you know, God created man and woman to be together.
Yeah.
And so to say that it's good for a man not to marry is just completely wrong.
Right.
Thankfully, the NIV 2011 corrected that.
Okay, good.
So now it accurately reflects that Paul is quoting the Corinthians.
Got it.
Metters even mentions that there was an entire academic article written about this.
Oh, wow.
By a scholar named Gordon Fee back in 1980.
So this has been a debate for a while.
Oh, yeah. Just pointing out how wrong that earlier translation was.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it's really important to have the right translation.
Absolutely.
So after addressing this idea in verse 1, Paul immediately shifts gears in verse 2.
Okay.
He says, "But since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife and each woman with her own husband."
Okay, so he's getting right to the point.
Yeah, and what he's doing here is confronting the issue of sexual immorality.
Right.
Which was apparently a big problem in Corinth.
Yeah, they already mentioned that there were some issues.
Right.
Okay.
And Metters suggests that this immorality might have been connected to, like, the common practices in pagan temples and banquets.
Oh, interesting. So it's kind of tied to the culture at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, go ahead.
So Paul's acknowledging that sexual desire is a real thing.
Right.
But he's affirming that sexual intimacy within marriage is the appropriate and valid way to express that desire.
Okay, so he's not saying just abstain altogether. He's saying there's a proper place for this.
Exactly.
Got it.
And it's actually a protection against immorality.
Interesting.
So then in verses 3 through 5, Paul kind of dives into the specifics of the marital relationship.
Yeah, okay.
And outlines the responsibilities between husband and wife.
Right.
What really stands out to me here,
yeah,
is how egalitarian Paul's view of marital intimacy is.
Oh, okay.
Like he says, the husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and the wife should do the same for her husband.
Right.
And then he goes on to say that neither partner has full authority over their own body.
Oh, wow.
But they yield it to the other.
That's a pretty radical idea for that time period.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Like, it's almost like he's saying your body isn't entirely your own anymore.
Right.
Like, it belongs to your spouse as well.
Interesting.
It's a pretty significant statement.
Yeah, it really highlights the idea of mutual dependence within marriage.
Exactly.
Like, you're in this together.
Right. And Metters points out that this isn't just a suggestion.
Okay.
The Greek word used here implies an obligation.
So like a must do.
Yeah.
Got it.
Now, there's a bit of a twist in verse 5.
Oh, okay.
Where Paul talks about taking a break from intimacy.
All right.
But he's very specific about the conditions.
What does he say?
He says, do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer.
Okay. So there's some caveats there.
Yeah. The key phrases are mutual consent and for a time.
Right. So it's not just a free-for-all.
Exactly. Okay. Paul isn't advocating for long-term or one-sided abstinence.
Okay.
He's saying if you're going to abstain, it has to be for a specific spiritual purpose.
Right.
And it has to be something you both agree on. Hmm. And it shouldn't be for so long that it creates other problems.
Okay.
He even says that after this temporary period, you should come back together to avoid temptation due to lack of self-control.
Right. So don't push it.
Yeah, don't push the envelope.
Got it.
Metters really emphasizes that Paul is not giving permission for one spouse to just unilaterally decide to abstain.
Okay.
Like, you can't just say, well, we'd be more spiritual if we didn't have sex tonight.
Right. Or I'm not feeling it tonight, honey, because I need to pray.
Exactly. Paul sees regular sexual intimacy as an essential part of marriage.
Right.
So then in verse 6, Paul says, I say this as a concession, not as a command.
Okay.
And this is a really important statement.
Yeah, what's he referring to there?
Right. That's the big question. Uh-oh. Like, what is the this that he's talking about?
Right.
And there are a few different interpretations.
Okay.
One interpretation is that this refers to marriage itself.
Okay.
Like, Paul is conceding that marriage is okay for those who struggle with self-control.
I see.
But Metters rejects this interpretation.
Okay, why?
Because marriage is presented as the norm in both Jewish tradition and the creation account.
Right.
So it wouldn't make sense for Paul to view it as a concession.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
So if it's not marriage itself, what else could this refer to?
Yeah. What are the other options?
Well, another possibility is that this looks back to the allowance for mutually agreed abstinence in verse 5.
Oh, okay.
So in this case, Paul would be saying, yeah, you can agree to abstain temporarily, mm-hmm. but that's not the standard. The regular pattern is sexual relations within marriage.
Okay, so it's like an exception to the rule.
Exactly.
Got it.
And then there's a third possibility that this actually looks ahead to verse 7.
Oh, interesting.
Where Paul says, I wish that all of you were as I am.
Right.
So in this view, this would be referring to Paul's wish that others were single like him.
Okay.
So he's conceding that he personally finds singleness advantageous, mm-hmm. especially for his ministry.
Right.
But he's not saying that everyone has to be single.
Got it.
He's not commanding it or expecting it.
Okay. So he's not putting that on everyone else.
No.
All right.
And that leads us right into verse 7, which says, I wish that all of you were as I am. But each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that gift.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot going on in this verse.
Okay.
So first of all, Paul's wish for everyone to be single like him.
Right.
That's not a command or an expectation.
Okay.
Metters points out that this is just Paul expressing his personal preference.
Right.
He found singleness to be really helpful for his ministry, mm-hmm. especially considering his belief that Jesus was coming back soon.
Okay, so he didn't want to be tied down with the MA responsibilities.
Yeah, he wanted to be free to travel and preach and all of that.
Right.
But then he goes on to talk about gifts.
Okay.
He says, each of you has your own gift from God.
Right.
And this is where it gets really important.
All right, what does he mean by gift?
So the Greek word used here is charisma.
Charisma.
Okay.
Not doron.
So what's the difference?
Well, doron is just a general term for a gift.
Okay.
Like something you receive.
But charisma refers to a spiritual endowment.
Oh. Yeah.
Like a specific ability given by God for service within the church.
So it's not just a preference. It's like a calling.
Exactly.
Got it.
And Metters draws on some insights from another scholar named Garland to kind of break down what it means to view celibacy as a charisma.
All right, so what are the implications of that?
So first of all, it means that celibacy isn't just a matter of personal choice.
Okay.
Or like a feat of willpower.
Right.
It's a divine enabling.
So God equips you for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Metters puts it really simply.
How's that?
He says, this isn't something that constantly occupies your thoughts.
Oh, interesting.
Like, if you're truly gifted with celibacy, you're not constantly struggling with lust.
Okay, so it's not a constant battle.
Right.
Got it.
Secondly, celibacy as a spiritual gift is often for a special service within the church.
Okay.
It's not just about personal freedom or avoiding responsibility.
Right.
And Metters contrasts this with the modern tendency to postpone marriage and kids for individualistic reasons.
Yeah, like I want to focus on my career or travel the world.
Exactly.
Okay.
He's saying that a true charisma is for the benefit of the whole church.
I see.
Not just for yourself.
Got it.
And then the third implication is that this gift involves a lack of strong, natural sexual desire.
Okay.
Now, Metters acknowledges that this is extremely unusual and hard to judge.
Right, because everyone experiences those desires to some extent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the key is that you're not constantly and powerfully compelled by these desires.
Okay, so it's not like a defining struggle for you.
Right.
Got it.
Metters makes a really strong point here.
Okay, what's that?
He says, this gift chooses you. You do not choose it.
Oh, wow. That's a powerful statement.
Yeah. It's not like you decide to be celibate.
Yeah.
It's something that God calls you to.
Got it.
And he emphasizes that Paul doesn't tell people to go find God's will about whether to marry or stay single.
Oh, interesting.
Like the norm, according to scripture, is marriage.
Right.
The gift of celibacy is the exception.
Okay.
It's a specific enabling for a particular purpose.
So if you're feeling called to marriage, that's probably a good sign that you should get married.
Yeah, he even talks about the idea of burning with passion.
Right.
He's saying that if you're constantly struggling with intense sexual desires, that's not really indicative of the gift of celibacy.
Right. That probably means you should get married.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he also addresses the reality that sometimes life circumstances can lead to singleness.
Oh, yeah.
Even when it's not what you desire.
Right.
He calls this negative providence.
Okay.
Like difficult or unwanted situations that result in you being single.
Right.
And he cautions against automatically assuming that this means you have the gift of celibacy.
Oh, okay.
Like, it could just be a reality of life in a fallen world.
Yeah, just because you're single doesn't mean you're called to be single.
Right.
Got it.
So, yeah, it's important to remember that.
Absolutely.
So, to kind of wrap things up,
okay,
what are some key takeaways from 1 Corinthians 7, 1 through 7a?
All right. Well, first of all, we see that the Corinthians were wrestling with these ideas about sex and marriage.
Right.
They seem to have had a bit of an ascetic view.
Yeah, they thought maybe celibacy was the more spiritual path.
Oh.
But then Paul comes in and clarifies things.
Exactly.
He affirms the importance of sexual intimacy within marriage mm-hmm. as the standard and as a protection against immorality.
Right.
He emphasizes the mutual responsibilities between husband and wife.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Right.
Yeah.
Really important. He allows for temporary abstinence,
right?
But only with mutual consent and for a specific purpose.
Yeah, and that's just because you feel like it.
Right.
Got it.
And then finally, she talks about celibacy as a spiritual gift.
Right, a charisma.
Yeah, a charisma.
Not a Doran.
Exactly. And he makes it clear that this gift is given by God,
right,
not chosen by the individual.
Got it.
And that marriage is still the primary expectation within Christianity.
Okay, so that's a lot to think about.
It is.
Yeah.
So here's a question for all of you listening.
Right.
How do these ancient perspectives on marriage, sex, and singleness
mm-hmm.
challenge or maybe affirm some of the views that we see in our culture today?
Right. Like, how does this line up with what we're hearing today?
Exactly.
Interesting.
How do you personally distinguish between what's just a societal norm,
right,
or your own desires
mm-hmm.
versus what might actually be a spiritual gift?
Yeah, that's a tough question.
It is. It's something to really reflect on.
Absolutely.
And if you're interested in learning more about this topic,
yeah,
I encourage you to check out the rest of 1 Corinthians chapter 7.
Right.
And also explore what the New Testament has to say about spiritual gifts and discernment.
Yeah, that's a great place to continue the deep dive.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
It's been a pleasure.
And until next time, keep thinking.
Keep thinking.